The following is Nate Shuda's talk, Choosing Which Mobile Experiences to Build, from the 2014 UX Immersion Conference.
So I have to admit, this is an interesting audience for me, because usually I'm like the lone developer at a developer conference trying to get other developers to care about design and usability and things like that. And so now I have an opportunity to sit here in front of a whole bunch of designers and hopefully try to help you guys understand the coding side and help you care a little bit about that. So it's a little weird for me to be on the other side of that script. But what I'll try to talk to you about this morning is some of the things that we think about when it comes to how to figure out what type of app to build, what technology to use to build that. And to sort of set this stage a little bit, I do want to throw out some stats at you, not because I think you guys need them. I mean, you guys decided to come spend a few days at a conference that's trying to immerse you in mobile, so I don't think it's for you so much as it is for the folks that you work with. Now, I work for a large company, and it's amazing to me how much resistance I run into when I talk to people about the need to do mobile stuff. So I'll try to paint a little bit of that story, you know, why is this an important thing, but I'll try to focus more on how do we choose between building a native app, building a mobile website, building something in between. What does that look like? What kind of questions do we go through in order to try to figure that out? And more importantly, to help you understand the trade-offs here. Because that's the truth with software. That's the truth with engineering. It's all about trade-offs. All right, so we'll start with a little bit of the backstory here. And again, I don't use this so much for your benefit as it is for all the other people out there in your companies. The growth here to me is just stunning. I haven't seen anything like this in my career. You know, just this flat-out explosion of devices. You know, we live right now in a world where Android activations outpace baby births. There will be more Android devices activated today than there will be children born around the world. And it's not even close. I mean, for a while, it was kind of neck and neck, and now I think it's almost a 2.5-to-1 ratio on the Android side. There's going to be more iPhones sold today than there are children born in the world. And again, this number's old, so we're way above that. Now, eventually there's a cap on this. Eventually everyone will have one of these and we start getting into the replacement cycle. But if your household's at all like mine, I've got 3 people and 6 iPhones and 2 iPads and 4 MacBook Pros laying around. So maybe I'm not normal, but at some point everybody's going to have one of these things. In a given year now, we're selling about 1 billion smartphones. All right, so think about that for a second. We've got about 1 billion PCs in the world. We've got 1 billion smartphones that will be sold this year. That's crazy. iOS is going to hit the 1 billion mark sometime in 2014, maybe early 2015. We'll see. To give you sort of a scale here, in 2011, Apple sold a lot of iOS devices. They sold more iOS devices in that 1 year than they'd sold Macs in the preceding 28 combined. So play that forward. I'd be frightened to kind of know what that ratio looks like today, given how much of their business relates to iOS. We got 500 million iTunes accounts out there. There's north of 700 million iOS devices floating around out there. We've hit the 1 billion number in Android. That's a big deal. And by the way, that doesn't even count about 300 million-ish plus or minus phones that are floating around in China. And so you look at how big that is and just the scope of that and how quickly that happened. I mean, this is a segment that did not exist 5 years ago, or at least not in any appreciable numbers. And here we're talking about billions. Billions are a big deal. Now, to give you a sense of this, there are 1 billion Windows PCs in the world right now. There are 2.2 billion internet users. So we're sitting here in a situation right now where there are as many mobile devices as there are PCs. And we're turning over those mobile devices a heck of a lot more rapidly than we are PCs. People are not buying new computers at the rate they used to. Some of that has to do with just the fact these things are a little more durable. They're not getting as fast. And you guys probably remember the era where, you know, you'd buy a new machine and then like 6 months later your buddy would buy one and it's twice as fast as the one you have, and you know, 16 meg ought to be enough for anybody kind of a thing, and now we've got gigs and gigs of everything. All right, so we'll always be buying new machines. I think that's pretty much a given. But think about your proverbial parents. You know, the machine they bought 2 years ago, 3 years ago, they're not going to notice much of a difference when they upgrade. So they're lasting longer, but people are finding they can do an awful lot of their computing on an iPad, on an iPhone, on things of that nature. Now, there are certain pundits who thought, well, you know, as soon as Windows 8 comes out, that's going to fundamentally change things. You know, because everybody's just waiting for the new operating system, because traditionally, when a new operating system comes out, people rush out and buy new machines. It turns out that hasn't been the case. In 2012, we had more Android devices sold than Windows devices. That's pretty stunning to me. Now, I love Ben Evans. I listen to him, you know, pretty devoutly. And this was just stunning to me. Look back at how quickly this set of devices has exploded. We're selling more iPads in a quarter than PCs when Windows 95 came out. And just look at that explosive growth. It's amazing to me. You could make a pretty good argument that in 2008, Windows had a very dominant market share. It was 95-ish% of the market. You had to target Windows because that's what everybody was doing. You look at where we are now, though, it's probably a lot closer to 30, and at this point, maybe 25. Who knows? But it's getting a lot less important than it used to be. I started referring to it as legacy desktop in my company. That usually gets me some scornful looks. To give you another visual on this, I love this chart from Ben Evans. So we got the blue line as PCs. You can see there's pretty steady growth there. And then all of a sudden, here comes Apple and Android smartphones. This is just smartphones. This doesn't even get to tablets. Doesn't exist. There it is. And oop, now we're bigger. I mean, that growth to me is just insane. I mean, do you run into people anymore that don't have some kind of a smartphone on them? I actually did. I was in New York over the weekend, and we were in this bar somewhere, and I looked over, and I saw this woman pull a flip phone out of her purse. And I almost thought I should take a picture of that, because it's such a rare thing to see in the wild. It's like, whoa, there's the last remaining one. All right? This is amazing to me. You take iOS and Android, combine them together, and it's bigger, or will be bigger, than the PC install base. Right? That's what Ben said. Now, the interesting thing here is look at the date on that. I'm no math expert, but if he's talking 6 months out, I think we're probably there now. We're probably sitting here right now in this room in a world where the combined iOS and Android install base is bigger than the global PC install base. What does that mean for the kind of solutions we have to start delivering? Right, so I'm pretty confident saying we're there now if we haven't already passed it. And I'm sure at some point Ben will come out with a nice chart that I can show you that'll have those lines crossing. And again, this is just on the smartphone side. You start mixing tablets into it and we get all sorts of interesting growth on top of that. If we strip out Android, we can see just in the iOS ecosystem, we have more iOS devices quarterly than we have Windows devices. We're selling an awful lot of these devices now, much more so than we ever did with PCs. Now, a lot of folks want to tell you that, well, growth is over, it's all spiked, you know, that's it, it's too late. We're sitting here in a world where every week 500,000 people are dumping their dumb phones. It took us a long time to get here. It took us about 16 years to get to this kind of magical billion line. And so you have to think, well, what's going to happen with the next billion? Because there's still a lot of people that haven't been served yet by this. Most likely, that next billion is going to take a whopping 3 years to get here. And we're already into that cycle. So we may only be 2 years, a year and a half away from the next billion people coming online. A couple years ago, we had about 3.2 billion mobile subscribers. In fact, we're sitting here now in a world where there is essentially a mobile connection for every human on Earth. That's not to imply every human actually has one, but there is a connection available. Right? And of this number, a billion showed up in the last 4 years alone. You know, so you start playing that forward and you think, my gosh, we still got 4 more billion people to come. And what's more likely? Are those folks going to rush out and buy some kind of a laptop? Some kind of a beige box PC-shaped thing? Or are they going to get a rectangle of glass? I'm fairly confident they're going to skip this transitional state that most of us have spent a lot of our career in and go straight to that rectangle of glass. And what's that going to look like? There's a lot of chatter about this over the last couple years, that we would be in a world where there'll be more smartphones than PCs. And once again, Mr. Evans has a beautiful chart to show us that. You know, here he strips out the tablet part of it, and you can see that would add into that. We're going to cross over if we haven't already. Now, I'm pretty confident in saying that has happened. And so it's just a matter of getting the numbers and putting it into a chart to prove it, so to speak. But we're sitting here already in a world where there's more mobile devices than humans. That's before we even start getting into that whole Internet of Things concept where, you know, your car and your coffee maker and your refrigerator are all talking to the Internet. Now, from our standpoint, we think about apps, we think about sites. It's pretty clear there's a strong appetite for downloading apps these days. Apple keeps coming out with numbers at quarterly releases. You know, last October, they told us they hit 60 billion downloads, billion with a B. Those are unique downloads. That doesn't include people, you know, doing updates or transferring to a new phone or something like that. I mean, 60 billion is a lot. December alone, 3 billion downloads. Everybody gets a new iPhone, a new iOS device, whatever. They run out, they buy all sorts of games and whatnot. Well, actually, nobody buys games anymore, do they? They're all free, and then you have to in-app purchase everything. So this shows you the App Store with Google Play mixed into it. It took a little while for Google Play to take off, but they're at a point now where they're moving just about the same number of units in terms of apps as Apple is. doesn't seem to maybe be quite the same economics, at least in terms of our standpoint from the development side. But best guess right now is we've had 150 billion downloads total across both ecosystems. And ponder that for a second, 150 billion downloads. Do we ever have anything even remotely close to that in the PC world? That's just insane. I saw this stat in a presentation about multi-device sort of targeting, and this kind of gave me pause. That in a given month, there are 9 times as many apps downloaded as hamburgers sold at McDonald's. McDonald's sells a lot of hamburgers. Roughly every iOS device probably has 83 or so apps on it. Android devices have roughly 53 or so apps on it, plus or minus. There's certainly money to be made here. Apple's paid out about $15 billion to date, maybe a little more than that now. Now, the economics of the app ecosystems are questionable. There's been this race to free, this race to, I would argue, kind of tricking our customers into giving us money. Not a particularly big fan of that. I'd rather see an ecosystem where people would be willing to pay $5, $10, $15 for real software. I think that ship has sailed, unfortunately, and we need to figure out how to work in that world. But it is clear there is money in this ecosystem. And when you look at Apple in particular, they're a huge music retailer, dominant music retailer in the US at least. And you look at how long it took to reach certain milestones in terms of billions of units, and then you compare that to apps. It's really remarkable to me how much different that curve is. Now, some of that has to do with price. There's no getting around that. I think, you know, average music price is going to be 99 cents, period, full stop. Yeah, some are a little cheaper, some are a little more expensive, but push comes to shove, you know, that's going to be 99 cents. A lot of apps are free. You know, I think average selling price is 19 cents, 23 cents, somewhere in that ballpark. And so clearly that has something to do with this. And apps have become almost this social thing. You know, you talk to somebody like, hey, you know, what cool new app do you have? And, oh, that sounds like fun. Let me download that and play with it. Or more likely, open it and then never play with it again because it doesn't look like that much fun. Delete it. My wife the other day was looking at her iPhone and she was kind of scrolling back and forth. She said, what are all these apps? I said, I'm not actually sure, honey. I don't know. Because I've downloaded a lot of things over the last few years. Looking at that data a little differently, you can see it's almost a 2-to-1 ratio in terms of apps to music. And then that little gold line is books. So you can see books are essentially a non-entity here. Again, that has to do with price to a certain extent. You know, a book's going to be $10. You're going to spend a lot more time with a book too, especially compared to music or an app for that matter. You know, but very, very clear appetite here for folks when it comes to apps. Right, so about a 2-to-1 ratio right now. You look at mobile web usage. I remember 10 years ago, the idea of like getting online on your phone was like this crazy concept. And now I was sitting down here trying to check my email. I was getting really frustrated because it was slow. You know, you've got to that point now where it's like, of course I can get anywhere at any time and I can check whatever fact I want and see whether I need a coat and all that kind of stuff. But mobile web usage is spiking incredibly in this country. Marissa Mayer was quick to point out a little while ago that Yahoo is seeing 400 million monthly users mobile. That a little surprising? Yahoo, 400 million? I'd be curious to know how much of that is like Yahoo Weather or services that are tying into Yahoo Weather. I wonder if that's part of what counts on their number. It's a big number, though. Facebook, half their user base is mobile, at least when you look at it globally. So that's somewhere in that half a billion range, plus or minus. You look at the US in particular, and it's huge here. About 80% of people that are using Facebook in the US are using it on mobile. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen my wife use Facebook any other way than on her phone. That seems to be the default for her. Most iOS users have Facebook installed, a surprisingly fewer number of Android users. I'm sure that will catch up shortly. Amazon does a lot of sales on mobile devices, that's for sure. There's some really interesting research that came out after the Christmas holiday season seeming to indicate that the attachment effect takes over when you use your fingers. So that when it comes to touch on a tablet in particular, people become more attached to that device because they've touched it, even though they haven't physically touched it. So they actually end up buying more, spending more. Kind of fascinating. Smartphone sales, this shouldn't be too surprising. We sell more smartphones annually than we do PCs, and it's been that way for quite a while now. And some of that's natural. Again, most people are not going to get a new laptop every 6 months, every year, every 2 years. We're probably slightly different in that regard, whereas almost everybody's getting a new phone every 2 years. Many of us are probably getting a new phone every year, maybe every 6 months. They're a lot easier to drop. You got to go replace them. But clearly, we're seeing a lot more of people's attention moving towards these devices. a golfing friend of mine. He's an older retired guy. And when the iPhone first came out, I very much tried to get him to buy one of those. And he's like, oh, no, no, you know, I'm too old for that. That's nothing that would appeal to me. And the following year, I met him out on the first tee, you know, beginning of the golf season. And we were chatting and he looked at me and he's very angry. I said, I got a bone to pick with you. I said, John, what could I possibly have done? I haven't seen you in 4 months, man. And he pulls his iPhone out of his pocket and he said, why didn't you make me get one of these earlier? I said, well, I tried. And for him, the killer feature was the fact that the keypad is so big when he tries to dial a phone number. Plus, he can see someone's face when they call him. But then about a year or two later, he bought an iPad. And I got to admit, I was surprised by this. I mean, I love my iPad. That's like a given travel aid. I can't imagine being on an airplane without an iPad. But the fact that he bought one kind of surprised me. And so, you know, 3-4 months after he bought it, I said, John, how do you like your iPad? And he looked at me and he said, Nate, I use it more than I have ever used my laptop. I can't even remember the last time I opened up my laptop, but my iPad, constantly in my hands. And I have found myself, over the last year in particular, my laptop sits for longer and longer of stretches, just sort of over there in the corner, pining, looking at me longingly, while my iPad is right there next to me in constant use. My son certainly knows what an iPad is. In fact, my wife, this weekend, he came into our bedroom, and it was earlier than she wanted him to be there. And rather than, you know, be an engaged parent, she said, go downstairs and play on the iPad and leave mommy alone. It worked out well for her. So you sit there and you look at this and you say, all right, well, what happens when everybody has one of these devices? What does that do to the kinds of experiences we need to create? And more importantly, when is that going to happen? Because, you know, if we're there, geez, we better be prepared for that. We better have some answers. And it's pretty clear, at least in the U.S., we are there. You know, globally, it's a little different, but at least in terms of the U.S., the EU, things of that nature, we have hit that point where you can more or less expect you run into somebody on the street, they probably have a smartphone in their pocket. They may not know they have one, though. One of the really interesting things when you dig into the data, there's a skew between the folks that are engaged, you know, in terms of using hotspots and things of that nature, versus folks that clearly are using their phone like a phone. And I think what we're seeing is there's a lot of people that walk into, you know, a Verizon store, an AT&T store, whatever, and they say, give me a free phone. And they walk out and they just happen to get an Android device of some flavor. For them, it is just a phone and something that they text with. They don't realize they have a computer in their pocket yet. I am absolutely of the opinion they will at some point. And then what happens when this huge mass of people figures out they can do all sorts of amazing things with this device that they're lugging with them literally everywhere? That's going to open up a whole new realm of possibilities for us. I was actually surprised by that. I was at my chiropractor's office last summer, and I was talking to one of the PAs, and she was asking me questions about phones, because she always sees me with my phone in my hand, so she assumes I have some knowledge there. I guess I do. And so she was showing me some phones she was researching, and every single one of them was running like Android 2.1, Android 2.2, and I pointed that out to her, and I said, now you realize all of these phones are running an outdated operating system. And she just kind of looked at me and said, that's okay. I just want it to make phone calls and send text messages to my daughter. I thought, I wonder how common that is. And as a geek, this surprised me, because I'm like, why would you not want to be on the latest and greatest? I was chastising one of my friends this weekend because he still has an iPhone that's running iOS 6. And it's not that his phone can't run it, he is choosing not to upgrade. He's making a statement, he says, I don't like the new operating system. I don't like the look and feel. They went too far. But I am very curious as just to how much that is a common experience for folks who think, yeah, I'm just going to use it as a phone. And then again, to me, the really interesting bit of that is what happens when they decide to start using it like we use our phones. What will that mean? Saturation is another way to look at this. So the idea of saturation is when a product has so entered mainstream that the idea of someone not having one is just bizarre to you. So a refrigerator, air conditioning, the DVD player. DVD player is the current reigning king of devices to get to saturation. We're going to get there much, much faster with smartphones. It will be the fastest innovation to get there. We'll hit saturation in the U.S. sometime in 2015 as well as the EU. Right, so it's going to blow the DVD player out of the water. So we're not that far away from being able to very comfortably just expect that when you run into someone, of course, they will have a smartphone in their pocket. There's been a lot of arguing over the last few years, you know, is an iPad or a tablet, is it a PC, is it a post-PC device, what does that mean? But if we do consider them separate items, we're already sitting here in a world where the tablet market is bigger than the PC market. You know, so right now, today, tablets are a bigger deal in terms of sales than PCs. You know, 2013 was a horrible year for PC sales. You know, just big decline every quarter. Now, some people have this belief, again, that now with Windows 8.1 coming out, everyone's going to rush out and buy new PCs. I don't expect that to happen. I am much more in line with this, the expectation that tablets are going to be at least half of the PC sales we see in 2014. So we'll be very curious to see once we get to the end of this year, what do those numbers actually look like. I was really surprised by this number, but half of all American adults have either a tablet or an e-reader. That's kind of remarkable to me. And again, you start playing that forward, and what is that going to look like? And that becomes almost everybody. Huge amount of traffic for shopping sites is now coming from mobile. Now, some of that undoubtedly is people who are at a brick and mortar store and they're price checking. And that drives brick and mortar stores crazy. In fact, you may have noticed this, but I know Best Buy, Target, and Walmart all have their own custom SKUs now, so that you can't use your phone to scan the SKU and see how much it costs on Amazon. It's part of that nice little retail battle that we're experiencing there. You guys all know the answer to this one, don't you? Most popular camera on Flickr, the site for people who like to share lots and lots of photos. It is, of course, not a camera at all, it's a phone. You know, the top four or five are always different variants on a phone of some sort. Now, considering how many people on Flickr are professional, enthusiastic, you know, hardcore photography people, and yet the majority of these photos are coming from a phone. Now, I have to admit, I can completely relate to this. I have taken so many photos, so many videos of my son using my phone, it's not even funny. In fact, two years ago, my son broke our little point-and-shoot camera. And my wife and I had this conversation, it's like, well, do we replace it? And my stance was, well, why bother? Both of our phones have better cameras than almost any point-and-shoot we're going to buy. She wanted one, so we ended up getting a point-and-shoot anyway. But we take far more photos on our phones than we do with that point-and-shoot camera. Shortly after my son was born, my in-laws got us like an actual digital camera, like video recorder kind of thing. And I got to be honest with you, we have videos on there of the kid. I have no idea how to get them off. Right? And I'm a software guy. Right? So if I can't figure out how to get it off there, I don't know how normal people do it. But videos I've taken with my phone, it's a no-brainer. You just plug it in and you're done. My folks now have gotten to the assumption, my son does swimming like, you know, one day a week, whatever it is. And if I don't send them at least one video from swimming, I get a nasty email. Where's my video of the kid swimming? You know, and think about that. That's a remarkable thing. 5 years ago, the idea of being able to take a 10-second video of your kid splashing in the pool and sending it to your parents, that was like science fiction. And now it's become an expectation. Of course you'll do that. I love this stat. How often do people look at their phones? 150 times a day. So you do the math on that, it's roughly what, 10 times an hour, plus or minus? Anybody think that's low? If you have teenagers, you know it is. But think about how many things in your life have gone away because of this. You know, there's all this talk about wearables. Oh, there's going to be an iWatch and, you know, Samsung Galaxy Gear, blah, blah, blah. I mean, let's be honest, how many people stop wearing a watch? It's a huge number of people. Because your phone always has the right time. If you happen to wander into another time zone, knowingly or not, your phone updates itself. The last time the clocks, what do? We spring forward. You know, of course, my phones just reset themselves fine. My computer resets itself fine. And I was walking into the kitchen and I looked at the range and I had this moment of pause. I'm like, why hasn't the oven updated itself? And then I had to stop myself and say, because I have to do it. And I thought, man, how Stone Age that my oven can't update its own clock. Now, it isn't just here. I mean, I'm very US-centric in most of the things that I'm focused on, but you look across the world and it's the same thing there. And China's seeing huge growth in their data use on mobile, huge. And this is having an impact on those carriers. You know, the era of we're going to charge you lots and lots of money for something that costs us nothing, AKA text messages, is going away. We've got ways around that now. This is stunning to me as well. You think about how big that market is. So we're going to end up in a situation where there'll probably be more smartphones sold in China this year than there are people in this country. That's a big market. That's a lot of devices. About a quarter of online sales in the UK are now mobile. A quarter. And some of this is actually like cross-device sort of things. I just did this last week. My wife wanted a new microwave. She didn't like the old one for some reason. So I began my research on my iPad. I found the microwave that I wanted, and I added that to my cart. And then she wanted to get my son a wristwatch of some sort. So she was doing that research on one of the laptops. And she's like, well, what do you want me to do? I mean, like, send you this? And she looked in the upper hand corner and, well, it's already there. My cart's there. Amazon knows how to make that all work magically, seamlessly. So I had this sort of multi-device purchasing experience that I had never thought I would do, and it was the most natural thing possible. BBC and their iPlayer, lots more traffic coming from tablets and PCs. Now, that to me makes a lot of sense. I mean, the tablet just sort of begs you to lay back and sit back in a nice comfortable chair and settle in. You know, even a MacBook Air or something like that's not quite as comfortable for that sort of thing. That makes sense to me. But still, another indicator of how important this is for people. You go to the developing world, and mobile is how people pay for things. 60% of Kenyans are using mobile for money. Globally, mobile is a huge amount of internet traffic. It's a fifth of it, 20%. I believe the rest is all Netflix. That's my guess. Now, again, I'm not trying to give you these stats because I think I need to convince you. I'm trying to help arm you with little bits that you can sprinkle into conversations you're having with your customers, with your clients, to help them understand why this is not something we can afford to ignore anymore. Because people are using their devices all the time, everywhere. They use it at home while they're watching TV. They use it when they're bored, waiting in line somewhere. I mean, my kid has gotten to the point where anytime we get in the car, can I have my phone? Dude, we're running to get milk. We're going to be gone for 5 minutes. Well, can I have my phone anyway? No, you need to be bored for a few minutes. We use our devices at work. This is one of the things that amazes me. Now, like many companies, mine blocks most of the interesting parts of the internet, which just means you reach into your pocket and pull out your phone and do the exact same thing you wanted to do. So what did we prevent? Not much. So these are becoming a pretty constant part of our life. They're becoming the sort of thing that, my gosh, how would we even live without it? And I always feel this anytime I travel internationally, and I get that wonderful text message when I land that says, by the way, if you dare to use your phone the way you're accustomed to, we will charge you a crap ton of money, because we can. Now, the most important thing for us, and the hardest thing, frankly, is we have to take a step back and say, all right, well, these experiences that we want to deliver to folks, what does that look like when it's on a mobile device? What kind of capabilities can we take advantage of? How do we make it fit on the weird screen sizes we have to now? And a lot of this is understanding this intersection. I love this. XKCD always has the answers. And so this is the proverbial college website. You've got the reasons people come to the site, the actual things that are there, and gee, what's the intersection? The name of the school. Now, ironically enough, a friend of mine was sitting in on a variant of a talk. I used this slide, and he works for the University of Texas school system, and he just started laughing. I said, what's so funny? He said, when we saw that, we took one look at our site and went, oh, crap, that's us. And they completely redid their website. XKCD, a course for good. Again, I think this is obvious. But getting folks in big companies to understand it has been a real challenge. Now, we have a mantra right now in our organization that if it's external, it's mobile. If it's outside our firewall, it is mobile, full stop. And if you haven't looked at your logs lately, you will be shocked at how many people are coming to your site using a mobile device. So the way we talk about this is it's not about, you know, targeting a specific browser or anything like that. It's what our customers want, whenever they want it, on whatever device they want to use. That's also kind of scary because whatever device they want to use turns out to be an awful lot of devices. And this should give you pause because I thought developing websites was really painful back when we had to deal with IE and Netscape. And then you fast forward to now and it's like, is there something else I can do with my time? Maybe I can get into sales? There's got to be something. Now, a lot of folks, their first reaction, especially from the software side, is I want to build a native app because native apps sound like fun and that's something cool and there's shiny new toys. But you got to take a step back and ask yourself, is that really what we need to do? Now, there's an awful lot of folks who think they have to build a native app, but that's not necessarily the case. There's a pretty good chance you can build what you want in HTML5. Awful lot of power there. And there's an awful lot of phones that can run HTML5. And so somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 billion plus or minus. All right, so I'm going to pick a little bit on Delta. I spent an awful lot of time on their hardware. Living in Minnesota, I'm a hub, so I don't really have a choice. If I'm on an airplane, it's going to be their colors. So just for fun, before I was building this deck, I went ahead and went to their site on my phone, and sure enough, the first thing it says is, hey, dude, go get the app. Come on, we built this nice fancy app, so go use that. I'm like, no, come on, just leave me alone. Just let me play around here on your mobile site. Let me see what you let me do. And frankly, it's not a lot. Now, I would argue, though, this is probably the core things that you need to do when you're on the move. Is my flight on time? If it's not, what are my options for other flights? And if I find a flight that's better, can I book it? Now, it's really interesting to see how many people are actually going to buy a ticket on their phone. And my guess is it's very similar to, if you guys can remember this era when the idea of buying like a book online was like crazy talk. I mean, who's going to trust a website with their credit card number? And now the idea of buying things any other way to me is just foreign. I mean, I'm pretty much in the opinion, it's like if I can't get it from Amazon, it probably doesn't exist. But you poke around a little bit and you see that, again, pretty minimal. Not a whole lot here. But again, I would argue they've done a nice job of getting the core right. These are the things you're most likely to need in a mobile situation. But you contrast that with their native app, which I use a lot. And you can see all of a sudden I can do a lot more things. And it knows who I am. I'm already logged into it. It can tell me how many sky miles I have, all sorts of fun stuff. I get the same information. I can book a flight. I can check status. It knows me, so it can tell me what my flights are coming up. I can go see details. If I'm within the 24-hour window, I can check into my flight. I can see my boarding pass. And we get all this other stuff. I can track my bags. And I can see traveling with Delta, so I can figure out if there's a Sky Club nearby. So much, much richer experience there. And partially related to personalization. Now, on the mobile device, I can always say, you know what, please show me the full site where I can get access to everything. But boy, that's pretty cramped on a phone, at least. That's going to require an awful lot of moving around, panning, and zooming. That's not going to be a really fun experience. Now, of course, it isn't easy to build that native experience. That requires a set of skills that some of us may not have. And so if we're going to go down that path, we need to ask some really hard questions. What operating systems do we want to target? Are we shooting for everything? Or can we narrow in on one or two? We had a lot of debates a year or so ago about, do we need to support Windows Phone? Do we need to support BlackBerry? We've come down very hard on the fact that BlackBerry is dead. The only way we're going to support that is if somebody screams and hollers at us. And most of us have pretty much said goodbye to Windows Phone as well. And then you guys start arguing about versions. Can we draw a line in the sand and say we won't support anything beneath this? Maybe, maybe not. If we're talking about Android, that gets really hard to do. The latest versions of Android are barely out there. Whereas the old versions are still, in some cases, 30% of the market, 40% of the market. And inevitably, in Android land, those updates come so late in the cycle that most people never bother. The only way they get a new version of Android is by getting a new phone. So Chiquita does a lot of advertising in this space. They know these numbers, at least in their ad network. Jelly Bean took 2 months to get to 1.5%. 1.5. When iOS 6 came out, it hit 15% in a day. 24 hours, it reached 15%. 48 hours later, it was in that 35% adoption range. A week later, and we're talking almost a huge chunk of traffic here, 60% and 40% of iPads have gotten updated. Right, so 17% adoption took iOS a day or so. Ice cream sandwich, it took 10 months. For developers, that's a real pain in the behind, to say the least. And it's gotten even faster now. iOS 7, 24 hours, 18% of devices. 24 hours. 3 days, and it was already bigger than iOS 6. People were downloading this like crazy. At one point during this upgrade cycle, 2.2 terabytes of downloads were happening every second. Think about the hardware it takes to serve that up. Now, some of that's the fact that you can actually just set a button that says, yeah, go ahead, update this automatically for me. I don't want to think about it anymore. Whether that's a good or a bad idea depends on your point of view. But in the first weekend alone of iOS 7's life, 200 million devices updated to it. In the first weekend. That's crazy. And so the uptake here is just ridiculous. Ben's got a great way of looking at this. iOS 7 has a huge number of devices, you know, and then still a pretty decent chunk on 6, but you look at the Android devices and we still have this massive chunk of people that are still on very, very old versions of Android, the versions that we, at least as developers, would rather ignore if possible. So fragmentation's a real issue. Don't let anyone try to pretend it isn't. It's easier if you're Google, because they've now pushed their sort of Play APIs out there, and they have some control that they didn't have before. But for us as development community, we don't get that luxury. Now, that's not it. One of the other real pain points here is the sheer volume of devices. I call it a deluge, because it sure is. And now we got to ask ourselves, well, man, which handsets do we target? I love this picture. This is one company's version of the devices they test with, and this was just the set they could fit on the table. This wasn't even everything. Now, I'm no math whiz, but let's just assume for the sake of argument there's 40 devices there. I actually think there's more than that. If it takes you an hour to test on each device and you've got 40 devices, that's a pretty long regression cycle just for 40 devices. And I'm guessing it's going to take you more than an hour, and I'm guessing you got more than 40 devices. So, man, what the heck do you do about that? One developer for his application discovered there was almost 4,000 unique devices that had downloaded his application. Unique devices. Now, that heat map obviously gets into a long tail scenario where there's a lot of devices that, yeah, there's like one of them. Who cares? You know, so really our focus is typically going to be in that upper left-hand quadrant. But if your really big important customer happens to be in that lower right-hand side of the chart, you don't have a choice. That's the world for me. If one of our big important customers pounds a table and says, this doesn't work on my insert esoteric device here, we can't say sorry. We got to fix it and make it work. OpenSignal has another way of looking at this, very similar. Again, long tail situation, a lot of devices in that Samsung Galaxy range, big shock there. But there is a just tremendous amount of diversity here. A lot of people call this the matrix of pain. And then we got to argue about sizes. It used to be so simple, or 3.5, 9.7. And now we have everything, literally everything. It almost seems to be this game of like one-upsmanship, especially in the Android space. So a friend of mine had a Galaxy Note 3, and so we gave him just incessant crap about that. You know, that's not a moon, it's a planetoid kind of a thing. And so he was the reigning king until this last weekend. Another one of our folks got one of the curved phones. I don't even know which manufacturer it was, but it made the Galaxy 3 Note, whatever this guy had, look like normal sized. And so it's remarkable to me to see how much diversity we have there. And of course, that's hard on us because they don't always behave the way we expect them to. You really would hope, well, sure, just target this, but not so much. Now, here's OpenSignal's visualization on that, and that just gives me the creeps. You know, that's an awful lot of sizes to have to deal with and try to figure out, is it going to work? Is it going to look right? Are the targets going to be the right size? Contrast that to iOS, and then people wonder, why do folks go iOS first? Because it's easier. It is a smaller target to cover. Now, this may change, probably will. You know, there's all these incessant rumors about a larger iPhone and maybe even a larger iPad. We'll see. But you look at the Android fragmentation, you think about these other sort of legacy devices, and Windows Phone seems to have pretty much bottomed out in that third spot. And then people start arguing about the Surface. I've got people in my organization that think this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. And they're very, very actively pushing that. Now, they are in the minority. But of course, I like to joke that, hey, we already had a Surface. Isn't that cool? It's a table. It's great. It's going to take off, except nobody bought it. Actually, ironically enough, I know a guy that bought one of these out of his own money. It was like 10 or 15 grand when he bought it because he thought that was going to be the wave of the future. Like, good luck with that. And of course, Microsoft had to reuse the name because, you know, what else could you do? It's not like they have a marketing department. Of course, now we've got, what, the Surface 2, and I'm probably going to get rid of the RT at some point here, but it puts us into this scenario where, my gosh, we can't possibly test on all these devices. You know, heat death of the universe will happen first. So we have to go into that with open eyes. And at least in our experience, you can pretty much count on about half of your development budget being spent on testing. And inevitably, you run into bugs that only occur on that particular device. And it didn't show up when you were using a simulator, and it didn't show up when you were using a WebKit browser, but sure enough, you get on the physical device and, aw, crap, now what? So if that's what we're targeting, geez, do we want to build a native app? Does that sound like the way to go? I mean, it's expensive. No getting around that. It takes time. Of course, none of these devices use the same, you know, underlying technology stack, so you've got to have a very divergent set of skills. And just knowing one doesn't mean you're going to be an expert at the other. So it puts us into a situation where we need to think about alternatives, and that's where HTML comes into the picture. Because luckily enough for us, these things have really good HTML5 browsers on them. So in most situations, most of our customers probably have a better browser in their pocket than they do on their desktop. That's not the case for you. You guys are all running modern browsers, but there's a lot of folks who aren't. So that does give us a relief valve. And I know a lot of folks think, okay, great, awesome, that's the way to go. We're going to build a web app. Now, there are three answers in computer science that will work for any question no matter what you're asked. Somebody asks you a question, my default answer is 42. Next step would be another layer of indirection. My all-time favorite answer, of course, is it depends. That is the answer. Should we build a native app? It depends. Should we build a web app? It depends. Now, I mean that. I know that sounds very glib. And by the way, when someone does give you that as an answer, the next question out of your mouth should be, on what? What does it depend on? How do I make that decision? Well, here's the way we look at it. First question I want to know is, who are you targeting? Who's your audience for this? Are we going after employees? Are they captive? Are we going after customers for whom we have absolutely no control? I was getting in this debate actually earlier this year with somebody. We were talking about building something for internal employees. And I said, great, let's target iOS. That's clearly the platform we prefer. It's easier for us to deploy that. We're still struggling to deploy some kind of a corporate Android offering. We got iPhones all over the place. We got iPads all over the place. Let's target that. Now, if it's customers, then we lose that luxury completely. You can narrow it down. We've done that. I think we target about a dozen devices as sort of our core kit, and then we go up or down from there depending on the application. Next question to ask yourself is, what's the purpose of this? Why are we building this? Is the app we're building the product we're hoping to sell? Or is it just related to some other product? Is it just sort of a helpful add-on to something? And very closely related to that, of course, is how are we going to monetize it? If I'm trying to sell the application, really hard to sell somebody a mobile website. Very, very difficult to monetize a web asset. Now, if you've already got an existing website that people are already paying you for, much simpler equation. But if I'm trying to convince you to, here's my new weather website, you should pay for it, good luck. And now, when the app ecosystems came out, a lot of people were just, you know, blown away that Apple and Amazon, everybody could possibly be taking a cut of the action. It's like, how dare you? But think about it from this perspective. Who's earned your trust? Apple and Amazon have a massive set of credit card numbers on file. They have made it incredibly easy for you to purchase from them. Almost too easy. Now think about some random third-party developer. Are you likely to throw your credit card number into some random website asking for a credit card number? Probably not. Now, I know myself, I've purchased an awful lot of things through Apple and Amazon in particular that I never would have purchased directly from the developer, from the retailer. But because it was through Amazon and Apple and I knew they were protecting my credit card information, we're good to go. So that's a huge part of those ecosystems. They have made it ridiculously easy for people to give you money. Now, we can argue about the economics of it. And like I said before, it pains me that we seem to have lost this market for people to actually pay for quality software. There seem to be a whole group of customers now who think software is free. We all know it's not. Now, the phone capabilities, the mobile capabilities, this is one of the really interesting aspects of these ecosystems, the kinds of stuff, the sensors and whatnot that these things have in them. This can make your decision really easy. If you're trying to take advantage of some aspect of the device itself, that may force you into the native aspect of things. Because unfortunately, the browser does not support everything. Now, some things are surfaced, some things aren't. I believe that will change over time. Although, let's be honest, there are certain things you will not ever want your browser to have access to on your phone. You've got so much personal information there, you want to have some kind of a firewall between that. Now, there are some HTML5 device APIs that they're starting to roll out. So that certainly is making that a little more of a level playing field, but it's certainly not as smooth as if it's a native app or a wrapper app. It's going to be hard to find this either way. You know, both app stores, the major app stores, have a ton of apps in them. It can be very difficult to find your app. Even if you know exactly what you're searching for, you're not always getting to the exact thing you want. But so is the web. How do you find a website these days? So I actually think it's harder to find things on the web because there aren't the nice related to and people who bought this also bought and recommendations and whatnot. Now again, if you have an established franchise, if you've already got customers, you've already got a relationship with them, some of that's easier in terms of monetization, discoverability kind of goes away. But it's still part of the equation. Now, some people have tried to convince you that building a mobile website is so much easier. And I would argue that's not always the case. Now, vendors in particular want to come to you and say, see, we have this magic shrink ray. We'll just go ahead
and... Man, I think you've mistaken me for a guy without a shrink ray.
By the way, that should be the expression on your face when a vendor says, I have a magic shrink ray for you. I would love it if that's what we could do. I really would. I would love it if we could just build what we've been building before and just press a button and out the other end comes this mobile optimized thing. That's not how it works. Now, I'd love to say it's the same thing we've been doing for the last 15, 20 years, but it's not. There are trade-offs here. A lot of the experience we have building websites in the past does not translate well to the current time. I've had this argument with some of my folks who think that all they need to do is get this grid to render on an iPad, and they've succeeded. You guys know better than that. You create a grid that's designed for a keyboard and mouse and then try to use it with these big fat things, good luck. That's not going to get the job done. the kinds of experiences that you can deliver to a laptop or a screen versus a 3.5-inch phone, pretty radically different. You have to deal with those constraints. Now, my stance on this is you've got to rethink the experience. Regardless of how you choose to surface it up, if you don't take the step of rethinking what that should look like on a mobile device, you will fail regardless of how you actually choose to build it. The actual technology implementation, to me, is sort of a wash. But it is a continuum between these options. And part of this, frankly, is understanding what your customers expect of you. If you are a major company today, if you are an airline, if you are a bank, and someone goes to their app store and types in your company's name and comes up with nothing, what do they think about your company? What does that make them think about the fact that, geez, this other bank has an app, this other airline has an app, why don't you? What is that going to do for your customers? It's pretty clear people like apps. We're talking billions and billions and billions of downloads, so there's something to that. I love this tweet from Ben. You know, everyone's always saying, oh, no, it's all about the web, it's all about the web. The only people who disagree are the folks who actually use this stuff, the folks we're actually targeting. There's at least some research that indicates people prefer a mobile app to a mobile website. And I very much agree with this. I do think apps are part of our landscape. And that's going to change what that means. You know, you start playing this forward a few years and start integrating with some of this other technology. What's it going to mean if I send you like a link from Yelp or something about a restaurant that we're meeting at? Now, it is entirely possible that the market will expect that you have an application, that there is something for you in the App Store. And if you're not there, again, that might say something about your company that may dissuade your customers a bit. Again, from my standpoint, the really important question here is not so much how we choose to build it, but getting our heads around what is it our folks are trying to do? What are they trying to accomplish with our mobile experience? What does that look like? The really hard part for us, especially, is how do we cut it down? Because there's no way all the features that fit on your legacy application are going to fit on the phone. You're going to have to cut some stuff out. And that's a tough conversation. Because if you've been in this line of work for any length of time, you know that when you talk to your customers, what do they want? They want everything. If there's 100 features, they want 120 features. Now, that's not going to work on the mobile device, so you have to have that conversation so much earlier in the cycle and get them to the essence so much faster and then be ready to cut a few more things. And that's a hard conversation to have. We've had a lot of knockdown, drag-out fights. It gets back to that XKCD thing, guys. We got to get that intersection right. We get the intersection wrong, and people delete our app. They never launch it again. Of course, you can have both. I mean, look at Delta. There's a website. You want to go there on the mobile website, knock yourself out. You want to get the app? Great, awesome. You can do more stuff. You're not required to use the app if you don't want to. You can still do most things on that website. So we have sort of three major options here. We can build a website. Now, in fact, in my world, we try very hard never to say the word web app, because as soon as we say the word app, people's heads start exploding, and they think all sorts of things that aren't true. And if you work in any kind of enterprise, you know how this game of enterprise operator works, and then you know you start hearing from, oh my God, did you hear that that group is building an app? They're not supposed to do that. They don't have the, you know, the authority to do that. So we just try to call it whenever humanly possible, a website. I usually bite my tongue every time I say it. So this is just the kind of stuff we've been doing for a long time. Whatever your current tech stack in, probably going to work these days. This is usually where we get into a responsive web design, throw a little HTML5 in there. Right, so this gives us a fairly straightforward way of doing it. Now, some people will just build a mobile website. Some actually will throw in a little bit of OS, sort of device-specific kind of things. It feels to me like that's kind of going away a little bit. You know, it's sort of a pseudo-hybrid-y kind of thing. You know, it runs in the browser, but it has a little more of an app-like experience. My favorite example of this comes from Amazon, at least a few years ago. If you went to their site on an iPad, it detected the fact that you were on an iPad. And said, hey, why don't you go to our iPad optimized website? Like, sure, why not? I'd like to see what that looks like. I'm a curious geek. So I went over there and, oh, hey, look, we have a cleaner experience now. Now notice the very first thing it's trying to do is tell me, hey, why don't you put this on your home screen? That's the real challenge in this space. How do I get you to put this on your home screen? With an app, it's easy. It just appears there. With a website, you have to take action, and that can be challenging for a lot of folks. Now notice, this is very different than the stock Amazon experience. it was even more striking to me when I went to the homepage on there and I saw, wow, they stripped away an awful lot of things. You can get a sense of the kind of stuff I read. Now, just for comparison's sake, I went ahead and pointed my browser at just the full-on Amazon experience, like, you know, literally 30 seconds later, and very, very different user experience here. Even look at the recommendations, how quickly those have changed. Now, I don't know if that's some metric they have that says, you know, people on an iPad are more likely to do this, that, and the other thing. I'm not really sure, but the very first thing that popped into my brain when I'm looking at this is, my God, are they actually using the same recommendation engine here or not? Because this is a very different set of you would like to me. And now, from my standpoint, this is a great place, this is a good option if you do face this, oh my gosh, we have to hit every device humanly possible. We have no control over that at all. Our ability to get this app out there in the market trumps the fidelity to the operating system. There's no getting around it. Nobody is going to look at your mobile website and go, oh, look, it's just like an iOS 7 app. If you don't need a capability that's only exposed to a native app, this works well. You know, and there's actually more in the browser than you might think. It's certainly gotten a lot better over the last few years. You can get a lot closer to that native-ish experience without having to go full bore into either building a native app or using one of the hybrids. If I don't need to worry about making money on this, not a bad spot as well. And if I don't care whether or not people can install it, this is an important part of it. Everyone in this room is capable of installing a website onto their homepage, onto their Springboard. A lot of our customers are not. They just haven't gotten there yet. They may, we'll see, but it certainly requires more steps than the idea of go to the App Store, search, hit download, install. The other really handy thing here is app review cycles go away. You want to push new code, you push new code, and you don't think twice about it. You don't have to worry about somebody getting in your way saying, hold on, wait a second, we want to review your stuff. Now, this is not a great answer if the experience you're trying to deliver isn't going to work in a browser. While I'm amazed at how impressive some of these JavaScript engines have gotten and the kinds of things you can build in the JavaScript engine are there and just kind of insane, if you're really trying to build a bleeding edge game kind of experience, that's going to be harder in the browser. So that's part of it. Same thing with capabilities. If there's a capability that's not exposed in the browser and it's key to you making a good experience, you're going to have to go native or go hybrid. There's other hardware features you need to get access to. That's the easiest way to get there. If you have the luxury of targeting, so you have a captive audience, you can say, this is going to run on a Galaxy S4, and that's it, that's all I care about, or this is going to run on a Nexus 7, this is great. Now, we don't often have that luxury. Although, if you're talking about internal customer type things, that does simplify life greatly. Now, if there are things that we can't do with the web, but we'd still like to kind of stay in that tech stack, we do have kind of this happy medium. We have this sort of shell or hybrid app approach. We call this a few different things in my world. Typically, we refer to it as a hybrid app. And so what we're trying to do there is you've got your standard web content in a web view, but we use some kind of a technology to package that up so that we can get access to native device features. And typically that's through some kind of a JavaScript layer that lets us call these APIs, and then under the covers there's an adapter layer that calls out to the actual, you know, operating system features. And so this is where we get into things like PhoneGap and Titanium, and Sentia Touch has, I think, Cordova built into it now, and, you know, all sorts of fun stuff there. And a lot of people think this is absolutely the perfect Goldilocks scenario. It's not too hot, it's not too cold. Is it the best of both worlds, or is it the worst of both worlds? There is a compelling argument on both sides of that coin. Now, there are undoubtedly some positives here. In theory, this is a write once, run anywhere kind of approach. Although, as someone who spent an awful lot of his career writing Java, which is supposed to be write once, run anywhere, I assure you that is rarely the case. But that's the idea. It also gives us the ability, again, to get through that sort of app review process. You know, at least once you get through the first one, it's just a matter of pushing new web content, and now it appears in that web view. From the development side, this is great because we get to live in our same normal web stack that we've used for the last 20 years, but we now get access to those native features through some kind of an adapter layer that lets us call in to that underlying operating system stuff. Now, it isn't perfect. Nothing is. In general, cross-platform has not really won the day. I know when Java first came out, that was its big claim to fame. You know, oh, we're going to write Swing apps, and, you know, everybody's going to love Swing because you can run the same thing everywhere, except for the fact that no Swing app ever looked attractive to anyone ever anywhere. I don't think I know anybody who actually uses a Swing app other than a handful of developers here and there. So that's certainly part of it, is the look and feel is never going to quite be right. My biggest concern as a developer, though, is I'm now stuck with one more life cycle in my world. I have to worry about the framework updating to the next revolution of the operating system. So when iOS whatever comes out or Android version this comes out, if I'm building natively and I want to take advantage of that API, I just go take advantage of it. I don't have to wait around for my framework layer to catch up. Now, I've actually posed this at some of the folks that manufacture this, and their answer to me was, oh, no, we're in the developer programs, and we're right there. In fact, we're usually releasing our version like the same day the operating system's coming out. I'm very skeptical of that. You know, any time that you're putting a layer between you and that underlying operating system, you've now got another dependency that you have to deal with. Performance is part of this equation, too. Almost without exception, these hybrid apps do not perform as well as a native app. It's not always the case. But in a lot of instances, you actually get better performance out of the browser than you will out of this hybrid web view. Although my biggest argument here is the uncanny valley, and I'll touch on that in just a second. But the fact that it doesn't look quite right is off-putting to an awful lot of users. Now, it can be an advantage, and I'll be honest, this is typically what we target. If we need to install it, it's almost always going to be a hybrid app. You know, we're just starting to kind of sniff around the edges of native development. We'll see where that leads us. But it certainly does help us with this problem. We write one code base that allows us to get access to a whole bunch of different devices. Right? Now, in our instances, we're not trying to push those devices to their absolute limit. We're not trying to take advantage of every single capability, but it certainly gives us access to an awful lot more than we get in the browser. If you care more about speed, again, of development, as opposed to it looks perfectly, you know, at home on iOS or Android, this is not a bad approach. Now, it isn't perfect. If you can target, again, native becomes a very compelling option. If you're trying to deliver the richest user experience possible, you're not going to get that out of a hybrid app. And you also need to be very aware of the hybrid trap. There's a lot of folks that start down this path because they think it'll be easy. Testing is still going to suck. Nothing gets you around that. You have to prepare yourself mentally for an awful lot of time spent testing. You will get defects that show up on certain devices with certain operating systems. It's just the bane of our existence. And anybody who tries to tell you that, you know, hybrid is perfect and it's this magic sparkle pony, they're wrong. But I'm very much of the opinion that for a lot of folks, they think this is the way to go, but they don't understand that, you know, yeah, it started out easy, but you run into this wall. There's a lot of folks that have shared experiences like this on blogs and whatnot saying how, man, it seemed like such a simple approach, and then we hit this stage of development and it all just came crashing down. There's a really, really good presentation that Rich Hickey gave at a conference a couple years ago called Simple Made Easy. I'm talking about how often we make the wrong choice when we think about simple versus easy. Now, the one thing I got to caution you on is as much as this seems like the Goldilocks pattern, it isn't. In this space, there are no silver bullets. There are no silver bullets, period, in software, but is at least part of the argument. Of course, that does leave native apps. And by the way, when you say app, almost everyone that's out there that isn't a geek is going to think of a native app. That's what they think of, that you go to the App Store, you install it, and what you're running is Objective-C or Dalvik or whatever it happens to be. So if you're going after all the device capabilities, this is the easiest way to get there. We're native. It's great. So you can use anything that the underlying operating system exposes to you. So it's got the best hardware integration. It's got the best hardware acceleration. This is where you start getting into a lot of the games. The graphics programming here is very powerful. It, without exception, gives you the richest possible user experience. And it absolutely looks right on that device, at least assuming you didn't run off and create all your own custom things, which surprisingly a lot of people still do because it's fun, apparently. From our standpoint, in terms of delivery, it's great. You just load it up in the App Store, get through the review process on Apple's side, and away you go. You've got a nice ecosystem that already allows you to get money from folks. That's all built in. However, if I need to target another operating system, that UI code is basically throwaway. There's essentially no reuse at that level, and I don't really have any skill set reuse between the folks that are developing in Objective-C and the folks that are developing in the Android space. Right? And of course, some operating systems let you do things, other operating systems don't. That's always good times. And so development testing times are often going to vary between the platforms as well. Now, this is a good approach, though, if what we are trying to do is sell the app. If that's our monetization strategy, if that's what the product is, this is the way to go. If I'm trying to provide the richest experience that I possibly can, this becomes very compelling. if the only way my app makes any sense is taking advantage of all these deep device capabilities, again, native simplifies that greatly. When it comes to the App Store installability, this is the easiest path, bar none. Folks understand this. It's easy. It's trivial. Now, it's not a great approach if you're trying to target dozens and dozens of devices. At that point, this way lies madness. If my app is simply an adjunct to something else, so it's an add-on to some other feature. I was talking to one developer where their company made jukeboxes that would be in restaurants and whatnot. So the product is the music machine, and people come up, they put their money in, and they play their songs. However, they built a mobile website, mobile web app, to allow a customer to interact with the jukebox from their table. So for them, they didn't have the luxury of saying this only runs on iOS, this only runs on Android. They had to target anything and everything. So they went ahead and built that as a mobile website because it was not the product. It was ancillary to that product. If you don't really need any device capabilities, why are you building native? That may not make a lot of sense at that point. You might be putting yourself in for an awful lot of development headaches that you don't need. So I don't know if I've answered this yet. I think the simple answer here is there's pros and cons to both of them. And there are some arguments to say that, you know what, it doesn't really matter. They're all web apps. Because at the end of the day, all of these things are interacting with some kind of a web server somewhere that's kicking back JSON, almost without exception. Now, undoubtedly, an awful lot of the things that we've built as native apps could be written in HTML5. No doubt about it. You could easily take most of the features that Delta has in their native application, port that to their website, and that would work. There's nothing strategic there that would change that. But the should is an interesting question here. Should we expose this as a native app? Should we expose this as a web experience? Again, it boils down to what you want to do. What are we trying to accomplish with this experience? Now, some people like to argue that, you know, publishers, they're not so fond of these app things. That doesn't work for them. Now, you look at the rise of some things like the magazine and Loop and things like that, and maybe they just didn't quite know how to get there. But I think the more interesting aspect of this to me is the uncanny valley. And this is an idea that comes out of robotics. And basically what it says is if you make a robot that looks like a robot, it's not creepy. You make a robot that looks kind of like a human, not creepy. Make a robot that looks exactly like a human, it's a replicant, that's perfectly fine. But there's some line we cross around 94% look-alike that, ooh, it's just wrong, it's just creepy. You're not quite there. So the best way I can do this to you is show you some pictures. So this is an actual robot. This happens to be from the Army, as I recall. That's a robot. Is that creepy? Not really. It's industrial looking, but should be. It's probably something that digs for IEDs and gets blown up. Here is a classic artist rendition of a robot. Also not creepy. As we all realize, yeah, it's not a human. What about this? Creepy, isn't it? That's a robot. This is in the uncanny valley. I don't know what it is about this. I don't know what's creepy about it exactly. I don't know if it's the hair, if it's the eyes, if it's the lack of a soul. Something here isn't right. And that applies to the interfaces we built too. Now, you're never going to get a defect that says, I deleted your application because it violated the uncanny valley of interface design. They're just going to stop using your app. So this is where we start getting into this debate about, well, how do we handle cross-platform? What do we do about that? Because it should, whenever humanly possible, look native on those devices. And believe me, people know what's supposed to look right on their devices. So I'm very much of the opinion that if we're going to build with our web stack, we need it to just look like a website. And if we try to make it look native, we're almost always going to fail at that. We're going to violate the uncanny valley, and our customers are going to be unhappy with us. Right? So quit trying to act like a native app if you're not building a native app. But I'm starting to wonder if the actual underlying coding technology of this is not the important question anymore. If what we're really struggling with is, how do I get this on the home screen? That seems to be the really interesting question in this debate. So if I took my iPhone out of my pocket, you'd notice I have a folder called Weather. And you'll notice that I have this thing called Forecast. Looks like an app. If I go ahead and launch it, you'll see something kind of like this. Oh, who am I kidding? For most of the winter, it's looked more like this. I come from Minnesota. Now, my question to you, looking at that, is that an app? Is that a website? Right. Here's the exact same experience on my iPad. I'm only mildly offended that it says middle of nowhere. Minnesota is not the middle of nowhere. I believe that's in Kansas. Same experience. I didn't have to install it. It's just there. Now, to make this even more interesting, let's go ahead and I'm going to put this in an actual browser. You see, there's Safari. Same look and feel, same information. At the end of the day, do our customers care? Is it important? Now, the guys behind this is forecast.io. They'll say it's an app you install from the web. And I agree with that. I think they've done a brilliant job with it. It's the best one I've seen. They worked really hard to make that happen. That was not trivial. That was not easy. That was not a two-day project. That was months and months and months of very hard effort to make that happen. Now, one of their big problems, hey, I tried to download your app, but I couldn't find it in the App Store. So convincing customers to install this, knowing that they can't just go tap, that's the challenge here. They built a great experience, beautiful experience. How do you get your customers to actually work with it? Ben kicked this out recently. I thought it was very fascinating because, you know, when we think about native applications, we often think of Apple, although many of us remember that Apple didn't have native applications when they first launched the iPhone. They were bullish on web apps and then eventually figured out maybe not. I think there's something to be said for that. I don't think we're done here. I think the evolution of this is just going to continue, and especially over the next 2 or 3 or 4 years, it's going to get even muddier in terms of, well, is that a web thing? Is that an app thing? Do we care? Do our customers care? As long as we're giving them a good experience? Now, I think this is a pretty exciting time to do what we do. And it's tough. It's a brave new world. There's a lot of really hard questions we need to figure out. It's kind of fun. There's no getting around that. I hate to say it, but there's an awful lot of options here. There's a lot of decisions. And you know, you may talk to one group and they say this is the absolute right decision for them, and it might be, and it might be the complete wrong decision for you. In my world right now, we've got, I think, 4 mobile things in flight. One is hybrid. The other 3 are all variants on websites with all sorts of different underlying technologies. We're also starting to kick around, well, maybe we should build some native things. What would that look like? In fact, I just ran one of my apps through kind of this review process, and my VP basically said, hey, it looked great. Why isn't this native? I went, oh, boy. VPs are thinking native now. That could be interesting. Now, again, I don't think this is a shock for you guys. We don't get the luxury of ignoring this anymore. And I think the real core question that we need to understand, not so much the technology underlying it, as what do our customers need? What's important? What kind of experience do we have to give them on these devices that they're starting to use all day, every day, for all sorts of things? Questions, comments, theories, queries? Do we have a microphone floating around? Yes. Excellent. Thank you, ma'am.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
In the case of Delta, I work for an airline as well, and
okay.
I'm facing the same trouble that they are facing. So we decided to go with a native app for iOS,
yep.
Another one for Android, and a web app as well.
Sure. Very common.
Not a responsive one, but doing for that.
An optimized mobile website.
Yep.
Yep.
At the same time, our developers in-house are working on responsive.
Sure.
Okay, so we were facing the trouble that...
We have duplicate code bases now.
Yeah, but yep. That's not a new.
Yeah.
But the thing is that if the user goes to a browser mm-hmm. and sees our 25,000 pages we have right now, exactly the same thing than Delta,
yeah.
And if he gets the browser small, he will see the responsive site.
Yep.
He will face something that the web app in Delta. Sorry, I'm explaining myself very bad. But the thing is, if you're building a mobile experience, that you are trying to give the same experience in a mobile app and a mobile web app, independently from where it's come from, mm-hmm. from behind, or it's better to give complete experience in some way and
sure.
try to get the advantage of the native app in the other way. does it make sense as a question?
I think one of the things we get caught up in is trying to give people identical experiences. And I think we should shoot for consistent experiences. And I think it's fine that there are certain things you can't do in certain scenarios. So I'll give you a perfect example. For a long time with Delta's experience, you couldn't buy on the mobile site at all. There was no way to buy a ticket. You had to go to the full-on legacy site to do that. By the same token, if you look at their native app, hey, there's Track My Bag. I don't know where that is on their web app, on their actual website. If you go to delta.com on your browser and try to find Track Your Bags, it may not even be there. Because part of it is just the reality of if you're at the airport, you probably can't whip out your laptop and get on Wi-Fi and search for your bag. But you know what? You pull your phone out of your pocket and you type in the number, more likely to take a picture of the little sticker they give you and figure out where the heck your bag is. Right? So my standpoint, it's very natural that that mobile experience is going to have different capabilities, do different things than the website and vice versa. You know, to me, the key is, are we delivering people the experience they need on the device they're going to use when they're going to use it?
So, thank you.
You bet.
A couple of years ago, there was a huge rush that everybody wanted a Facebook app.
Yeah.
Right? Do you still consider that an option, or do they live permanently in that creepy valley you were talking about?
We have never had a discussion about building something for Facebook. It wouldn't surprise me maybe if some of the marketing people have played there, but at least from our side, I've never heard that come up. I would very much put it in the, ooh, that's creepy. And how much data is Facebook having about me now, and do I want them to have that? So.
Hi, so I work for a large healthcare company. We have about 9 million members, so you can imagine, and it'll probably grow with the Affordable Care Act.
Yep.
So basically, we have a native iOS app, a native Android app, and a crappy MDOT that we're redoing now.
Sure.
Like, we're actually starting over, and we're taking a lot of inspiration from our flagship apps. So I'm just kind of, is there like a gut reaction to sort of the strategy we should take? We have a lot of content that's still not, like a large part of our website is still not responsive yet, and we have to do the whole content audit. So I'm just kind of curious what, I mean, do companies ever sort of get rid of their native apps after a while? Maybe it's too soon for people to be doing that. I don't know.
Well, I can speak a little bit about Delta in particular. I know they started with native apps that were written directly for each of the devices. They eventually replaced that with more of a hybrid-like layer. I can't remember exactly what they're using under the covers, but they're not directly building native anymore. Is that a good or a bad thing? I don't know. Honestly, their old experience I liked a little better than the new one, but you know, so from that standpoint, they did that because they didn't want to have multiple code bases. You know, so that's really part of the trick. Is like, can I maintain an iOS code base and an Android code base and my web content as well? But the other question is, can I afford not to? You know, if I can't deliver the experience that people are looking for in a unified code base, then I just have to bite that as the cost of doing business. And if that means I got to hire some extra people, then cost of doing business. You know, now I do think responsive is great for content. I'm less bullish on that in terms of input. I think it's too simplistic to say that if we just shrink it right, it will work for fingers just because. You can do it, but it's harder, I think.
Yeah, we're taking like an approach where, I mean, the experience is going to be very different on mobile, tablet, desktop. I mean, but we have people sending emails and refilling prescriptions and looking at test results. And so there's a lot of different stuff going on in addition to reading content.
Yeah.
But I just didn't know if kind of now that we have we've launched our native apps, are we kind of locked into them forever?
I wouldn't think so. I mean, Flappy Birds went away, right? Maybe it's coming back, but it just depends on what you need to do to surface your needs. You know, the key thing that I look at is we want it to be consistent. We want our users, if they come to us, however they come to us, to not go, oh my God, this is a totally different company. You know, they want to have that familiarity. And I give Delta a lot of credit for that. They've done a brilliant rebranding across all their platforms. You know you're on Delta's site. You know when you're at the airport. They're not identical, and I don't think they need to be. I don't think they should be. I think that way lies pain. If you try to take every single feature you can do on Delta's website and put that on the mobile website, it would be overwhelming at best. If you try to take every single feature and put it into their native application, it would be even more overwhelming. So to me, it's the key of figuring out, all right, what do people need in this context? And so the fact that Delta's mobile website allows you to do the bare minimum things, and I would argue those are probably the top three or four tasks, would not surprise me if they had data that said, you know what, 80, 85, 90, whatever the magic number is, percent of people that are coming to our mobile website, this is what they're doing. And nobody's complaining about the three things that they can't do there. You know, so to me, that's a big part of it, is what do they need to do here? What's useful for them to do there? So. You bet.
You mentioned the whole thing about, you know, if you want to take advantage of native functionality, you know, the OS functionality, getting to use a native app. But I find one interesting antithesis to that is Amazon's app, where you can browse books, you can look at books, but you can't actually buy the book on iOS. They won't allow you to purchase because of their conflict with Apple, so you actually have to go to a web interface.
You're talking about Kindle, right? The Kindle
side? Kindle app, yeah. Yep, so you, yep. Then you have to go to a web interface in order to purchase a book.
Right.
So in that case where you are forced by, you know, various legalities to have to go to a web interface, how close would you make that web interface match your app in order to keep that consistency?
That's a good question. You know, I don't think a lot about that because it's, to me, it's so natural just to go to Amazon on my phone and just tap, and I don't even think twice about sending it to my Kindle app. I don't even try anymore. You know, I think for Amazon, you know, it's pretty clear that they're sticking with the, this is what it looks like on the website. You know, that seems to be kind of the 80, 90% case. And I think that makes a lot of sense for them because that's where so much of their traffic is coming. If they tried to make that experience look like the Kindle app, I think that would be more dangerous. I don't think that's useful to them. You know, so the Kindle app's designed to make it easy to read a book, you know, whereas that website, they've made that really good at buying product. Too good in some cases. So, but it's consistent. You're never sitting there going, oh my gosh, what am I on? Is this Barnes & Noble? No, you know it's Amazon. So, yeah.
So if somebody decided to go the hybrid route and then for whatever reason down the road wanted to then focus on a native app for each of the platforms, would it be possible to then serve that native app as an upgrade to the hybrid app?
I think it would depend on the ecosystem. I'm not certain if that can just be installed as an update or if it has to be a separate app. That's a good question. You're going to end up throwing away the hybrid app. That's one of the things that I find really interesting about the space we're in. The UIs have gotten a lot more ephemeral. I mean, you guys all remember we used to build apps and it's like, okay, good, we got that app now for 10 years. We don't need to worry much about it. We'll just kind of spiff it up a little bit here and there, but that's going to be the thing for 10 years. We don't have that luxury anymore. We're going to build a UI now that's going to last a year, 2 years, and then it's going to get replaced. And if we architect that such that most of the businessy stuff is happening on the server and JSON, RESTful Web Services, all that fun stuff, then we can make this front end be what it needs to be, and especially as we start targeting whatever's coming next. That's the part, I mean, we just focused here on these little rectangles of glass. Take a step forward. What's it going to be in a year, in 2 years? I have no idea. I guarantee it's going to be different. There's going to be something we're going to have to target in 2 years that we're not even pondering right now. You know, if it's going to be your glasses or your watch or your car, that's where life is going to get even more interesting. And you start mixing that into it. But yeah, so I'm not exactly sure what the underlying app stores would allow there if that has to. I mean, it probably could be an update because from their standpoint, they're getting the proper, you know, wrapper anyway. They're getting, what is it, an APK, and I can't remember what Objective-C compiles down to, but they're getting that unit. They don't necessarily care what's in it. So, yeah.
I know we're talking about web here, but there is one other case that I've seen where you really have to go with an app, is if your client, and if you know who your client is, and they're going to go to a place where they don't have web access.
Yeah.
Where they're going to a federal site or a secure site, and they don't have web access. So that's another one of those decision points. You know, if web access is not available, go to the full-on app.
Yeah, you can do some offline with web. It's certainly not nearly as
it depends what they need. If they're going somewhere where they need the latest and greatest,
yeah.
You know, it's one of those things where it's just, well, they have when they're going from your site to whatever, say, service place they're going to,
sure,
they need to download the latest.
That's a good point.
Before they get there.
It's a great point.
It doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen.
Nope, it's a good point.
You saw the weather site, you know that you saw the weather site. You saw the weather site, which looks like, you know, the app.
Weather.io, yeah.
Yeah, weather website. And I know that how you do it in iOS, but it is achievable in Android or Windows Phone.
My point with forecast.io is the fact that that was not easy. You know, there's a lot of folks who posit incorrectly that, well, if we build a website, it will be easy. It's not. They put a lot of effort and time and energy into that, and it was months of development to get something that smooth and that rich. And if you look at some of their blog entries, they talk about some of the testing they would do, and they're really big on, like, random testing. Just do random stuff and see what happens. Try triple taps, try double taps with two fingers, try all sorts of strange things that are not normal. Not like the happy path part. We all think of the happy path. That's easy. You know, but it's all that oddball kind of things. And so if you are trying to accomplish something like that, don't think that's a two-month project just because it's on the web. Okay, there we go.
Hi, I just wanted to say it's been very interesting hearing you talk about all the it depends, because I work for a large enterprise company, and we have been down this route. We started out exploring. We wanted cross-platform. Yep. That's the way we wanted to go, because even though our apps are for our employees,
sure,
we have a mix of iOS and Android. We started down the Meep route.
Okay.
And that was a whole experience.
I bet.
And never quite served our purposes. Then we went down the hybrid route and did several apps under CinchaTunch wrapped in PhoneGap.
Okay.
And it does work to a certain extent, but some of the things that you've explained about, you do hit walls.
Yep.
You have access to the native APIs, and you can go offline with the local storage, but you're limited on what you can get.
Yep.
And we've hit a wall, and now we're exploring, and now we're doing a native iOS app.
Sure.
Because it answers all those questions. We have noticed that the usability and the performance is greater, the ability for data storage. There's so many more things we can do that I have a feeling that we're going to push ourselves into native and go ahead and
sure,
take the hit and add resources for both Android, you know, for Java resources and Objective-C resources to do those native apps. But we've kind of went this full circle. That,
yep,
that you've been talking about.
Yeah, that's not uncommon. And it would not surprise me in the least if we do end up start sniffing around the native stuff. I mean, the conversations have been ongoing. We've actually got a guy who's doing some experimenting there. Unfortunately, they're trying to experiment with a cross-platform way of doing native, and it's like, why? If we're going to build native, let's build native. You know, this notion that a developer can't learn Objective-C, as a developer, I find that insulting, right? Anybody can learn a programming language. Anybody can learn a second programming language. You know, that's not the hard part. And I think the interesting bits here, and this is where we struggle a lot, is understanding that this is a different kind of architecture. You know, if you put these things in RESTful web services, that's where all your business logic lives. That's going to be reusable. Mm-hmm. The front end won't. You know, and have we ever gotten reuse out of the front end? Honestly? You know, so if we do this right, if we have a proper separation of concerns, great, we build a native app, no problem. There's work there. I'm not trying to diminish that in any stretch, but it's not 2 years worth of work, because we've got the web services already, and we'll reuse those in our new skin.
Right.
And considering that at some point in the next 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, we're going to have to target something else. To me, the idea of arguing about, well, here, we got one code base that's going to cover it. There'll be something in 2 years that, oh, crap, we need another code base now.
Right. And actually, when we did our hybrid apps, we found them not to be as cross-platform as you might imagine.
Yeah.
We ended up with two separate code bases. There's certain APIs that you'll incorporate from third-party vendors,
yep,
that will be different for each of the platforms. And it's just not as cross-platform as,
right,
you might imagine.
Yeah, you end up having to write some native anyway. Thank you for sharing.
One of the things that I always find when you have this discussion is you always have to think about what your customer is going to do. I mean, so often we've seen this decision, we're going to go ahead and build an app, but that doesn't mean your customers are going to do it. It's,
sure,
kind of this field of dreams. If you build it,
they will come. They will download.
But, I mean, using your Delta example, like, I fly Delta twice a year, and I happen to fly Delta here with my brother who flies Delta every week.
Sure.
Well, he has the app on his phone.
Right.
I'm never going to put that app on,
no,
my phone. There's no reason for me to put it. So how you pay attention to your customers and, well, which ones are most likely to actually use the app.
Yeah.
And if you look at Delta's app, it actually looks like it's catered more towards their frequent flyers.
Absolutely.
Than
it
is for someone like me who,
yeah,
there's no way I'm going to, if I do download it, I'm going to uninstall it right after the,
right,
trip anyway.
Right.
So it would make sense to cater that more to your frequent flyers.
Well, and let's be honest, for Delta, where do they make their money? They make it on their frequent flyers, you know, so they certainly have a little different way of looking at it. Now, if you're a bank, I don't know if you can be maybe quite that picky, you know, where you might have to, this experience has to work for somebody who uses it twice a year and somebody who uses it every week. So but that's a great point. Everybody's ready for lunch, aren't they? We good? All right. Well, guys, thank you so much for spending some time with me today. I appreciate it.
For more great UX resources, visit uie.com. That's uie.com. As always, thanks for listening.